This is an ABC podcast.
Aloha kākou, whakatālo whātu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And as always, we proudly bring our show to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. While it's drought season, and it's causing major water shortages in Micronesia. Australian Defence Force are looking to recruit from the Pacific, but can they? And they're set to hit your TV airwaves tonight. That's right, the Pacific is back. Get ready for some amazing storytelling from the team. More on those stories shortly. And you'll be able to find them online once our show is done. Simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. Feel free to share across your social media platforms. And remember, we're across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific. We really do welcome your comments there too. But let's get on with the show. I'm Aggie Dubow and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, dry conditions in parts of the northern Pacific have led to severe water shortages on some islands. Parts of the Federated States of Micronesia and Marshall Islands are affected by the water shortages, while Guam is also under a dry spell, with authorities shipping or flying in drinking water to those affected. As Dubravka Volodya reports, it comes as the US Drought Monitor has upgraded conditions on Waterjay in the Marshall Islands and on Yap in the Federated States of Micronesia from severe to extreme.
Isidore Robert is worried. It has not rained in parts of Marshall Islands for months, and there's very little drinking water left for the population of some 9,000 people living on the smaller northern islands and atolls. Mr. Robert, who's the Marshall's Disaster Management Office's director, says they have sent aid to affected communities.
Delivering what we have, a portable reverse osmosis machines that we go install badly affected areas. Some atolls and islands have invested in these kind of machines. The ones that do not have are the ones we've been responding to.
So does that mean you ship or you air freight water there, or how does it work?
It's a case by case. So there are instances where we had to fly it in due to availability of transportation, or vice versa. We had to ship it cold by ocean due to availability of flights.
Meteorologist Landon Adlett says many of the area's smaller islands depend solely on rainwater.
You have a mix of the higher islands. Those are islands with mountains and vast jungles. And then you have the low islands. Those are the outer islands, small islands that are about 5 to 10 feet above sea level, and also those coral atolls. Their drinking water source is only from the rainfall. And so when the rain stops, there's very limited and a waning supply of drinking water availability.
Mr. Adlett, who's with Guam's National Weather Service, says Yap in Micronesia and Watye in Marshall Islands are hit hardest.
With no rainfall, they have no fresh drinking water supply coming in from natural sources. So that all has to be shipped in from relief vessels or from reverse osmosis units.
He says bringing aid to some areas is challenging.
There's been some tight moments across some of the outer islands because it does take time to get vessels into some of these islands that don't have a grass runway strip for small planes to come in. So right now we're not in a dire situation, but things are escalating. And the longer it takes before the rains return, we're going to have to keep the full pressure on these response efforts.
Parts of the Commonwealth of the Marianas, Palau and Guam are also experiencing dry conditions. But while Guam's groundwater levels are full, so they are not worried about shortages, Mr. Adlett says they are concerned about fires.
It's more the wildfire threats, because we've not had a robust wildfire season in a number of years. So now all this vegetation started to dry out. And so we're looking at the higher likelihood of increasing fire danger across the island here. Right now, it's a proactive messaging campaign to prevent outdoor burning. That we're sharing that information on how to prevent fires and how to be fire safe.
The dry spell is also affecting crops in some areas, with the leaves of some trees already turning brown. The authorities say they are planning to send food aid should things get worse. Mr. Robert in Marshall Islands says they are managing for now.
It's pretty bad, but it's not as bad where we have to seek external assistance. We can manage it within our own government.
More heavy rains are forecast for most of the areas, but not until June.
And that's Dubravka Volodya with that report. Well, there's nothing fake about my next guest. They are as real as they come. As we all know, the Pacific region is rich with culture, people and stories. And you know, who better to bring that to life is the team from the Pacific program, bringing you the stories that matter to the Pacific with the most up-to-date information from journalists with deep regional expertise. And guess what? They're back on your TV screens as of today. And the co-hosts of the show are joining me live in the studio this morning. I would like to welcome Johnson Rael and Alice Lolo here. How are you guys doing? Malolele. Kia ora na.
Good morning.
Yeah, it is. It is probably a little bit too early for you both, but that's okay. I appreciate that you've made the effort.
Oh, no. We like to work out early in the morning, so we've been awake for 3 hours.
I love that. Thank you so much, guys. I must say, the program has continued. I do realize it's going to be coming back today. How are you both feeling? What has the journey been like so far? Can I come to you, Johnson?
Yeah, I think nothing really changes for us. All it really means is that we get excited that we can tell our people's stories and tell more stories, really, because, I mean, we have, in a TV term, we call them seasons, and there's such short seasons. So for us now, it's about, rather than telling, we want to tell as many stories as possible, but we have Pacific Beat, we've got our ABC Pacific platforms. But for us, how can we tell more impactful stories and really spend the time with our people in the region, not only with ourselves traveling too, but our reporters in the region, really spending that time with our people. So that's what excites me. So things don't really change as much. It just means we need to do things better.
Nice, I love that. Alice, I want to come to you but for both of you, you have been doing some traveling to find those stories. Do you mind sharing maybe just where you've been able to go to find some of those stories, Alice?
Yeah, sure. I was lucky enough to go back home to the motherland, to Tonga, and I spent a while there with our wonderful reporter, Marianne Gupo. One of the stories we were looking at in the kingdom was the welfare of deportees. They were formerly called deportees. Now they call them returnees. But yeah, it's an incredible story that each of them have. And it was nice to be able to sort of give them a platform to share that story, because I think for so long, you know, they've sort of been relegated to the side, a lot of stigma, you know, against them. So yeah, it was nice to be able to spend that time and actually meet the people behind the stigma.
Yeah. I do want to stick with you though, Alice, in regards to that, because what actually draws you to a specific story?
I think for me, like this is going to probably sound a little corny, but it's the humanity aspect. You know, I had, when in Tongan community, you know, like deportee in Tongan is the pota, and that word alone has a lot of stigma. And so I always used to wonder, like, why do people look down on deportees so much, you know? And they definitely get judged for their past, you know. A lot of them get sent back to the islands because of crimes they've committed. But a lot of them are trying to turn over that new leaf and figure out, how can I be, you know, a better contributing member of society for where I am now? And I think that's what got me the most. So it was such a privilege to be able to just sit down, listen to their story, you know.
Beautiful. Well, we look forward to seeing that story. Same for you, though, Johnson. Was there something that sort of stuck out for you in regards to stories that you were following?
You know what actually sticks out to me is the fact that I am the only male on our show, really. I'm surrounded by all these really strong, powerful Pasifika women, you know, our reporters in the region. You know, shout out to our reporters in the region, you know, Lethe in Fiji, Chrissy in Souls, you know, Marion in Tonga, also Adele in Fiji. But we've also added to the team, you know, shout out to our listeners in PNG with Belinda Cora coming on board. And actually, Bells is on our show, on our first show. We're going to have a chat to her about the PNG election special. And here's one that sticks out to me is that that PNG haven't had a census, a population survey since 2011. And even then, those numbers are thought to not be correct. And, you know, well, you were talking about it earlier this week yourself.
That's right.
With Bells too. And so, that's where we got the story from. So thank you.
that's what I'm here for, guys.
So we're going to continue on with the story that you started earlier this week. And, you know, lots of people don't really know what the actual population is of PNG. So, those are the things that really stick out to me, because I think quite often, and Alice is from Tonga and I'm from the Cook Islands, and, you know, we've had to learn ourselves how to unlearn a lot of the things that we have learned because we're initially from Polynesia, if you put it in that sense. We're all from the Pacific region, but man, the things that fascinate me is our Melanesia and Micronesia family. And Micronesia is where we also need to do better.
Yeah.
So we are going to look at a Kiribati selection special later on this year. Actually, next week, speaking of elections, one of our producers, Gabby, has just got back from Solomon Islands, and she's actually sitting outside working on it now, on our Solomon Islands election special that she worked on with Chrissy. And so, and that's going to be a whole show dedicated to our Solomon Islands election special. So, and Chrissy's going to front that. And that's exciting that these are the opportunities that are available to our amazing women in the region.
I love that. And, you know, you talked about your cultures, of course, Alice Tongan, Johnson, representing Koke Airani. In the last season that I saw a lot of colour in your wardrobes. And, you know, and when someone's watching that, I mean, I'd like to know, what does it mean to have to share that part of you in terms of a cultural representation, Alice?
Oh man, that's actually one of my favorite pieces of feedback. You know, when people say, "Oh my gosh, you know that's my cultural attire." I love representing other Pacific cultures on screen, because how often do we get to see that, really? You know, so yeah, it's a way for us to honor as many Pacific cultures as we can. We are a Pan-Pacific show, and just to see the delight, you know, and the happiness that people get from that's just one small part of the job, but it brings so much joy.
And as for Johnson, I think I heard some feedback of you looking such a handsome person on screen. What does it mean to have yourself represent also?
Oh, look, I'm not going to lie. It is very flattering. But you know, our people love seeing our own attire. And it was funny, because we just thought, we'll do this. Alice was dressing me in some Tongan attire, and, you know, put it up on TikTok, and then we wore Tuvalu in attire. And we, you know, like Alice said, we like to spread the love. But the comments that come through on social media, you know, and the one of the most powerful ones is just, you know, members of our community saying, wow, we never thought we'd ever see this on mainstream television, you know?
Yes, Alice?
I do have to say as well, sorry, not to make it about myself, but yeah, there is a reason why I keep my hair curly as well. You know, we don't see a lot of Pacific women with like curly hair. You know, I think a lot of the times we get pressured into westernizing ourselves a bit. But that was also one of my favorite things, you know, people messaging in just saying like, man, I never see my hair like this on on TV screen. So if I can rip the curly head, girls, I will do it.
Yes, please. It's beautiful to see. And look, I know you guys are very busy this morning, but I do want to ask, just so that our listeners are in tune, what can they expect for tonight's episode or first episode, and where should they head to?
Yeah, so in tonight's first episode, we've got a beautiful story coming out of Fiji, looking at rugby player welfare that Lethe and our producer Sean and Hugo's have been working on. And so we're looking at, you know, the deaths, unfortunate deaths of a young boy that happened in Fiji 1 year ago. And we talked to his mother and his family about what's happened, and also the fact that they haven't had any answers from the Fiji Rugby Union. And as we've heard here on Pacific Beat, Fiji Rugby Union is in chaos at the moment. But, you know, things that are happening in the coaching side of things and administration, that's taking a lot of the spotlight. But we need to look at some of the things that's, you know, really in the background, and that's rugby player welfare. Because as we know, as Pacific people, we will keep training and pushing ourselves, and we will not tell anybody that we are hurting, that maybe we are a little bit sick. So that's one of our one of our key features this evening. As I mentioned, we cross to PNG. We also look at get an update from Marian Kupu around the Tongan Parliament, yes. Things that are happening there. But we also celebrate 30 years since the Fuimana family released their urban Polynesian album.
Wow!
And so for those that aren't aware who the Fuimana family is, you just think of How Bizarre with Paulie and Phil Fuimana. So we've got a really nice little feature there. They've re-released their album from 30 years ago, which was actually the start of how the whole How Bizarre kind of craze and world fame kind of started. So we go back to they actually live in Melbourne, but we pay homage to South Auckland and Otara. And so that's kind of a nutshell of what we look at with our show this evening. But I'm so excited to be back.
Absolutely. And it is. It sounds like a packed show. But again, Alice, can you let us know where people need to head to?
Yeah, sure. Should I mention the times?
Yes, that would be great.
So in PNG, the show will be airing at 5:30 p.m. I feel like I'm announcing train times. The show will be airing at 5:30 p.m. And in Solomon Islands, 6:30, 7:30 in Fiji, and 8:30 in Tonga and Samoa.
Okay. Well, look, to our listeners who are tuning in, please make sure that you do tune into The Pacific. It is premiering again tonight. I do want to say metaki ma'ata malo pito for both of you for joining us this morning. All the best for the show. Very, very proud of you both.
Thank you, sis. No worries.
That was Johnson Ryle and Alice Lolo here from The Pacific here on Pacific Beat.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between.
Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, there's a shortage of lawyers in Guam, and it's become so dire that CEOs who hold legal licenses are being forced to take on criminal cases. They're being appointed to represent defendants on the island who can't afford a lawyer. Marion Farr spoke with attorney Joaquin Arriola Jr. about the issues it's causing in the court and prison systems.
Well, it's impacting actually the entire practice of law, primarily in the criminal side. Under the Constitution, everybody's entitled to a court-appointed lawyer if you are unable to afford one. And when there's conflicts of interest and there's not enough public defenders who work for the court to achieve these cases, they end up appointing private lawyers in the bar. And in this case, it's gone to the point where they had to go to the private bar and appoint senior lawyers, 70-year-old lawyers, real estate lawyers, corporate lawyers, bankruptcy lawyers, even vice presidents at the banks are being appointed to come into court and handle murder and rape cases and assorted misdemeanor cases and theft cases and the like. And not only is it not achieving the proper goal of giving effective assistance for these people, it's affecting everybody else's other caseloads because the courts dictate the practice of law. So if they tell you have to do this much continuing education, or if you have to do this much pro bono free work for the people, then you normally have to comply with those rules. And one of those rules is you have to take on court appointed cases when the court calls on you if you are in the active practice.
So how many practicing lawyers are there on the island?
There are currently only 274 active lawyers on the island practicing for both the governments, and there are about 150 in private law firms, sole practitioners, and the like. And so that's the current composition of the bar. In its heyday, the Guam Bar used to have upwards of 450 members, active members on Guam. So we're now down to, 274, according to some of the numbers I was looking at the other day. So there's a significant decrease in the number of lawyers available. Over the years, we've lost a lot of lawyers due to aging out, as we call it. We've also lost a number of lawyers just due to simple generational gaps. there is no law school here, so we have a hard time recruiting lawyers. We all have to go off island, and Guam requires that you come from an ABA accredited law school, which is an American bar accredited law school. And there's only so many of those across the country. So recruiting lawyers to come back has always been a problem. And it's just come to the point where we're seeing what's seen as a crisis, because it trickles down and affects everything else. When your civil clients can't collect on their claims and your probate clients are not able to close estates, everything else suffers as a result.
What impact is this having on the prison system?
The prison system is overcrowded. It's certainly very, very, very overcrowded. They're intense and the conditions are not conducive. I mean, to think that in this day and age, we have to sit under a tent in the 90-degree weather, literally a pop-up tent outside and speak with our clients. But meanwhile, the guards standing right there, the conditions are not necessarily the best, that as good as they should be.
Now, you mentioned that because of this shortage, all sorts of lawyers, contract lawyers, civil lawyers, real estate lawyers, and so on, are being asked to take on these low-paid criminal cases. Is that prompting some lawyers to leave the profession?
Oh, yeah, yes. As a matter of fact, we had reported that there was a 12 or 13% decrease from active lawyers to practice law. You have to be an active member of the bar. They've gone inactive. Paid a lesser amount of dues and have pledged not to practice law.
Yeah. So what do you think is the solution to this issue and how urgent is it?
It's always been urgent. That's just it. This has been an issue that's been under revamp for many, many years. There is a provision in Guam law that allows any lawyer from any state in the United States who has their license, good license to practice, to come to Guam to work for the government only, either as a prosecutor, a civil government lawyer, or work for a government agency, or work as a public defender. And they will get paid the same as any other local resident employee. They don't have to take the bar exam for at least 5 to 8 years. So they can practice for the government without having to take the examination. That is unlike most states in the nation. And that's one way that they've resolved the problem, by recruiting active lawyers from the mainland who want to come to Guam and not have to take the bar examination, but do government work for at least a few years until you have to take the bar.
Do you think that risks compromising the quality of lawyers in Guam?
There's been that concern. There's been that concern. You know, there's the old people taking advantage of the situation. Maybe they can't get a job out there. Why are they coming out here? Why are we attracting several lawyers? You know, and it's been known to happen. It has been known to happen that certain people, some have come out, taken advantage of the situation and wreaked havoc. And then they take off.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground having conversations and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And let's get into our next story, where the Australian Defence Force is facing a bit of intense scrutiny as to why its workforce is well below its authorised threshold of 62,000 personnel, with 4,000 people less than its current levels. Ambitious goals are being set to boost its numbers of 18,500 people by 2040. But where exactly are these numbers going to come from? It looks like the Pacific might just be the answer. But to unpack this a little bit more, we're joined by former Honorary Director and Adjunct Professional Centre for International and Regional Affairs at the University of Fiji, Richard Hur. With that, I say welcome, Richard. Oh, it looks like Richard is not coming through as of yet. Can you hear us, Richard? Yeah. We'll have to go to a quick break because it looks like Richard's not coming through as of yet. I apologise for that, listeners, but you are tuning in to Pacific Beat.
It was missionaries and colonisers who brought Christianity to the Pacific over 200 years ago. But in the years since, the region has become a melting pot of diverse faiths, beliefs, and philosophies. Pacific Soul explores this and asks, What Do We Believe? Join host Melissa Makin for a talanoa about our faith and beliefs on Pacific Soul. Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Apologies, team. We have been trying to work it out. Hopefully we can get a hold of Richard. But let's head to another story here. I'm not an official judge with Guinness World Records, but I think this might just be the biggest bunch of bananas ever. Well, at least the biggest I've ever seen. You might have spotted the photos on Facebook of a collection of bananas that stretches metres into the sky. The bananas are part of a custom trade called Neil on Tana Island in Vanuatu. Marin Farr spoke with William Nanuna, who photographed the impressive display.
Is collected by a community. They collect all the bananas from that community. I mean, every village around the Nakamal, each of them bring the bananas to the Nakamal. Like each of them, everyone who is doing gardening, who is farming, they have to bring bananas. When the chief agree, they all agree with that custom ceremony, which is called Neil. So they decided which community should we trade the bananas to them. So it's called Neil ceremonies. And most of the communities around Tana, they do that not just for bananas, but every fruit trees, you know, tradition, the community that receive banana will decide next time if they see in the community or whatever fruits that we have in here that's plenty and that's too much. So they have to give back what they have taken to the community. So,
wow.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. William, do you know how many bananas altogether were collected for this custom ceremony, this one in particular?
It's like 500 bananas. So, yeah, I think it's roughly 500 or 400 bananas.
Wow, that's a lot of bananas. Yeah. And yeah. How long did it take for the community to get this big collection of bananas together?
They did it for 3 days, I think.
And so from the photos that you have posted online, it seems like all these bananas were collected and then strung up into this sort of big bunch that it is about, I don't know, maybe 5 meters, or how tall do you think that bunch of bananas is?
I think it's 20 something meters. Yeah.
Wow, my estimate was way under. So 20 metres worth of bananas.
Yeah.
How are these even being delivered to the village? How are these sort of bananas being taken to the nearby village where they're being gifted?
They hired trucks to move the bananas to their village.
What made you want to photograph this big bunch of bananas? What made you want to photograph this in particular?
Because it's one-time ceremony that you can see it for maybe one time in 1 year or two time in 1 year. Yeah, so it's interesting when you hear that there's a Neil of something, Neil of this product, whatever product they want to give to trade it. It's very interesting to just go and watch. And
Yeah, really interesting. And now you posted these photos on Facebook. What's the response been like to those photos?
The response was absolutely great response. You know, for that one of the reels that I've made, it's been shared 367, I think. Yeah, so they were all over, Vanuatu and Solomons and even Vichy in Australia. They have messaged me, oh, wow, it's a great thing to see.
Yeah, and I guess people really love learning about custom and seeing custom and culture in practice.
Yeah.
And that was Vanuatu photographer William Nanua speaking with Marion Farr here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, it's third time lucky, and let's hope that we have Richard Herr, who is the former honorary director and adjunct professional fellow at the Centre for International Regional Affairs at the University of Fiji, with us this morning talking about the Australian Defence Force and, well, will they be able to get numbers from the Pacific to join? So, Richard, I do want to say welcome. Thank you so much for being very patient with us this morning.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you again for being so patient with us this morning. Well, as we get into the story, I was talking about the Australian Defence Force. Wonder, Richard, if you could maybe even just start us around the fact of, are you aware as to why they are struggling with numbers? I mean, how do you think they even got into this predicament? I mean, and I'm talking about not just recruiting, but maybe even the retention of personnel.
It's difficult to know. I think as some of the parliamentarians, Tasmanian Jackie Lambie, has made the point that the benefits of service aren't really commensurate with the risks and the opportunities in other areas. So it's not looked as an attractive, just as a career. And on top of that, of course, there has been a long time since people have felt a threat where the service looked necessary. So I think it's just that we've been in a period where there's been rapid change both in the expectations of people looking for a career and the concept of service to the country. It's combined to make it more difficult to persuade young people to consider the military as a career.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that appeal for, I think, the Gen Z to be quite patriotic or want to defend one's country, as you say, isn't as attractive as it once was. So this whole ADF's recruitment from the Pacific, and let me be clear, I know that it's Melanesia, Micronesia, Polynesia. You see this as a positive move. How so?
Well, basically what we thought was that Matt Keogh's kite-flying exercise of suggesting that this would be one area that could be explored, should be explored. That's basically, it's not going to be a silver bullet. There isn't any reason to expect that even the larger share of the new recruits would come from the Pacific. But it's just that there are good reasons for not excluding it as one of the options for helping to regionalize the Australian Defence Force, as well as to give our neighbours a chance to pursue careers that they may wish to do. And we know from Fiji and from the Micronesian states, the U.S. Micronesian states, that there are people who would like to pursue that as a career.
But can we maybe get a bit of clarity on who can be recruited? Because I thought that it was only ever open just for Australian citizens.
This is right. And I think that one of the benefits of exploring this would also be to allow the Pacifica diaspora in Australia to find another path to citizenship, a quicker path to citizenship, as occurs in countries, for example, like the US, where people who hold green cards but are not yet citizens can join the military and expedite their citizenship opportunities.
Richard, some would say that this might cause, of course, a bit of a labour drain from the Pacific. You know, like, are we double tapping those who are already struggling with their people leaving their homeland to even work in what we have here in Australia, like the PALM scheme, seasonal work? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I agree that it's an issue. But on the other hand, we're not necessarily talking about double tapping. We're talking about people who expanding the opportunities for which they can find overseas employment and find a career that's satisfying. At the moment, they're simply excluded from it by virtue of the limitation on who can be recruited. And by looking at this, I mean, people, for example, there's some 6,000 territorial reservists in Fiji who've had military training, who are on the reserve list in Fiji, who might well find the opportunity to go back into active service as part of joining the Australian Defence Force and, achieving Australian citizenship would be an attractive offer. It certainly has been for the UK, at least.
If it's not been an attractive offer to those here in Australia, but more so for the Pacific, what do you think they would be entitled to?
Well, I think they should be entitled to, they would have to be entitled to all of the services. And indeed, that might, in fact, be, as we've seen with the Micronesian entities, a pressure to make sure that the post-retirement or, post-recruitment benefits are improved to a level that makes the service as a whole more attractive. But other areas, for example, we've had the Pacific patrol boats in the Pacific now for a whole generation. The people who've been involved in that program with good naval experience really have no career options for themselves in the military. They can go back into a civilian service, perhaps, but the options that available to them from the experience they've had in that in the Navy, as it were, their patrol boat experience, simply gets lost. So again, it's not that this is going to be the silver bullet for recruiting. It's simply that it helps to provide Australia with a more diverse Pacific-oriented force that, and indeed with climate change and the like, and we've seen that the disaster, humanitarian and disaster response is increasing, the need for this is increasing, and it helps to have people with local knowledge and cultural experience to be part of making that a more successful mission. So it's not, as I say, it's not going to solve the problem of the shortfall entirely, but it is a kind of niche solution that ought to be explored and I think could be beneficial for both sides.
Yeah, and I do want to bring up the situation, though, because in regards to recruitment and their processes, there was a Fijian military officer involved in a serious assault on a Fijian businessman, but then had been appointed to a senior position in the Australian Defence Force. So clearly this highlights that there are some flaws within that recruitment process, yes?
Well, it wasn't that he was recruited specifically. He was on an exchange program, but you're right. The relationships would need to be clearer. The fault in that was on both sides. The fact that Australia didn't do the due diligence, and the fact that Fiji chose not to raise the concerns that had been around him. But we have under the agreement with the Solomon Islands, there have been Fiji RFMF troops in Honiara. Under that agreement, there are still Fijian troops, but they're working under an agreement that exists between the Solomon Islands and Australia. So, this would simply be a way of helping to more formalize that from internally within the ADF.
Richard, I know you say this is just at least one option for them to be able to try and bring in numbers because, you know, we've reported many times on security agreements being made in the Pacific. It does then just make sense to recruit from the Pacific, right?
Well, I think it does, especially when you put this in historical context. When you look at the Pacific Isle microstates and compare them with the Caribbean microstates, the level of self-responsibility is much lower in the Pacific. Now, there were good reasons for that at independence. It was a felt that the region didn't need defense forces. They didn't need to prepare for their own defense. But then again, there were no alliances either or defense agreements to help provide that. So there's been a gap there that when you compare it, as I say, with other microstates, the islands in the Pacific have been less engaged with their own defense. And that's, I think, part of why some of the recent developments have looked more dramatic than perhaps they should.
And then finally, as we wrap up, we've just got about a minute here. What do we do then? What does ADF have to do just to better encourage and promote the people joining?
Well, I think they have to make it. They have to make the pathway. First of all, it has to be adjusted so that it doesn't require full citizenship before you can join. I mean, that's the critical one. There's no point in saying we will make it more attractive for islanders to join if they're in fact statutorily unable to join. So there's a lot of homework that would need to be done. And I think at this stage, I just would encourage the ADF to do that homework and to look at the ways in which we can be more mutually engaged with the region and provide career and other opportunities for Pacific Islanders.
Well, Richard, we thank you so much for your time this morning just to have a little bit of an insight into this topic. And thank you again for being patient with us. We finally got there.
My pleasure.
No,
thank you.
No okay. worries. That, of course, is Richard Herr, former Honorary Director and Adjunct Professional Fellow for the Centre for International and Regional Affairs at the University of Fiji. Well, guess what? That literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories. Dry conditions in parts of the northern Pacific have led to severe shortages on some islands, as meteorologist Landon Adlett explains.
With no rainfall, they have no fresh drinking water supply coming in from natural sources. So that all has to be shipped in from relief vessels or from reverse osmosis units.
And a reminder, the new season of The Pacific is on ABC Australia, airing across the region tonight at 5:30pm at PNG time. Appreciate your time. We will be back next week Monday, but you can hear our show this afternoon at 5pm. Coming up is news. After that, it's Nisha Daily. Until then, o toa o whaantu, you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.